Also, I have to say that I like this event and this this group, and always we are prompted to think about something. And this year I was not sure what I should present, but But then we had the idea, so to talk a little bit about information society and maybe what kind of mechanisms could be identified here. So, and this is what I'm going to speak about, and it is about. I will have three parts of my presentation. So, the information society mechanisms or whatever are the middle part, and the first part is, let's say, where I depart from. That is. As you might know, I'm a little bit espoused with systems theory, but not with a traditional one and not with Luhmannian one and so on. I will try to figure out my own systems theory approaches. And I have come to call that, if we apply it to the social realm, critical social systems theory. So, and I want to just give a small account of what I understand by that, because this is a perspective from which I would like to look at mechanisms. And the third one is I want to present a hypothesis of or a proposal for one mechanism which seems for me very important as to the change of the social formation, but also it can be on lower levels for conflict transformation. So this is what I'm going to talk about. So critical systems theory. I'm used to differentiate between three perspectives or three levels or whatever dimensions of every science, that is aims, scope, and tools. So aims is what is the impact on society. What do we? What are the? What is the purpose of a discipline? The scope is what is the object of study, and the tools is the methodology. So how do we do it? So criticism. So critical social systems theory is a kind of combination between critical theory and systems theory. Yeah. So criticism and systemism. So so the philosophically formulated aim of criticism is the sublation of antagonisms. And antagonisms originate in heteronomy. That is, in societies in which there is domination. And what this critical theory should do is to provide knowledge of concrete utopias. So I will then elaborate a little bit on what is a concrete utopia. This is a term by Ernst Bloch, who was around the circle of the critical theory of Frankfurt School type. The scope would then be the dialectic of agents in structure, which is not very new to you, because all the social realists will do that. And the third thing is to say that everything you also investigate empirically has to be put into the context, into an overarching context, and this context is made by society, in particular by history and totality. Yeah? So totality is here the term which would be the proper term for of critical thinking. So this can be translated easily in systemism, in the systems theory terminology. So the aim is to transform social systems into higher order states, and this transformation should be based upon scientific anticipations of a sustainable future state. Yeah, so that's the purpose of critical systems thinking on social systems, to anticipate sustainable future states and to propel the transformation into higher order states of social systems. The scope is then self-organization. So I have talked already about self-organization in 2012. And so this is just what we here refer to bottom-up and top-down emergence, so actors giving rise to emergent organizational relations. And the tools then should translate from the context of history and totality into the context of social systems development and social systems evolution. Okay, and then after hearing yesterday Pier Paolo, yeah. I introduced here a little bit, a small introduction on self-organization, in which I wrap it up from a different perspective, because you started yesterday with saying what is a mechanism, and that is a kind of black box, which is either mechanical, then there is no black box, so to speak, because it is a one-way thing, yeah?
It's trivial.
Trivial, or it is a non-trivial thing. And so this reminded me of how I define self-organization. And so this is a picture which is also addressing this, which is self-organization is the intermediating mechanism, let's say, yeah, between input and output. Yeah. So, and here I would like to draw your attention to the differentiation between a patient and the agent. So, the idea is what is an agent and what is agency. And my idea is agency comes from self-organization. Without self-organization, there is no agency, I would say. Yeah. I draw the word patient from Raphael Capurro, philosopher in Germany. Of information ethics. So he made the distinction between agents and patients, and this is very important. So what is the patient then in my idea? And this has to do now with the differentiation between mechanical systems, or the, what did you say, simple causality and the self-organization, the complex one and so on. So a patient is something that has one option only. So if there is an input coming from the environment, the patient has only one option. Yeah? And he realizes that option. So there is no other way. An agent has many options. Look. So if there is a certain input, the agent has several options, and the agent now has to choose between these several options. And now look, the mechanism, how this works, is self-organization. So the agent chooses between these different options, chooses one, and that's the... This is now what reminded me yesterday, your talk reminded me of that. Therefore, my plea is self-organization is a generic mechanism of all and everything in the world. Yeah? Self-organization not in the social realm, but everywhere. But, of course, also in the social realm. So, just to remind this, if we come to the idea that there is causality, every mechanism must be based on causality, and if you, as you see from the heading, you see that I would not like to use that term. I would rather like to use the term dynamism, because it's dynamics what is going on, and this mechanism is, as some of us said, okay, it has the connotations of being mechanical, and therefore is not as good a term, especially for social sciences, I would say. So there's a cause, and there's something that is caused. I don't put the term effect here, because then you would already imagine it is an effect, an effective cause, and this is what I don't want to connotate here. Also, therefore, yes, there's something caused. This cause can be necessary. That is, if it is necessary, that is what we saw now before as a patient acts, or reacts, a patient reacts. So this would be necessary, and it would be a bijective mapping between the cause and the caused. So this is strictly determined, and this is what I understand by mechanical. Yeah. So there's only one option, therefore it's mechanical. I push a knob, and then only one option is realized and nothing else. Second, the cause can be contingent, then the mapping is not bijective, and it is rather conditioned. That is, the cause is rather a condition. Yeah, and in that way, I put it in brackets. That is, it is conditioned by a necessary but not sufficient condition. That is, the cause is necessary, but it is not sufficient to lead to just that effect or whatever it is, to that caused, yeah, to that which is caused. And if this is so, and if the counterfactualists would understand this in that way, I would rather join them. But I'm not sure, so this is just an open question. Yeah? Just to say, okay, the cause must be necessary, but what then is caused can have different options. And also the other way around, that which is caused can have also another cause. This is also the implication of being not bijective. So, okay, next. I want to introduce the four Aristotelian causations. I had already a paragraph. So I had already some paragraphs on that in the first article in our first book. So the efficient cause is something which seems to push. Well, I go back. The efficient cause is something which pushes something from here and now to the future. Yeah. So that is on the diachronical dimension. Yeah. And the interesting thing is that Phil already has talked about this, that science has forgotten all the other causes of Aristotle, and it would be nice to have them. And 10 years ago, I had a research project in which we came to that conclusion, which I will present here. Yeah? And that is, the efficient cause is not really alone, because on the same level, you can see there is also a final cause. And the final cause is something which looks as if something would come from the future. But it is not true. That is, that is also systems, whatever systems, they have a kind of attractor to which they are attracted. Yeah? That is, the final cause is something which we want to realize if it is humans, for instance. Yeah, and this means that there is a delicate balance between the efficient cause and the final cause. So the final cause does, in a way, harness the efficient cause and makes the efficient cause end-directed. So there's no efficient cause that is not, in a way, end-directed to the least amount, okay? So then we can add the synchrony, this synchronic dimension, and then we have clearly the material cause of Aristotle, and we have also here an opposite. This is the fourth cause of Aristotle, the formal cause, and here is also the formal cause that in a way harnesses the material cause and forms it, it shapes it, and it structures it. Yeah? So the material cause then is structured. And this is the way to see that all this, that at least two, that there are two pairs of causes of Aristotle which are connected to each other intimately, and also both of them are connected because they are just two different ways of looking at it. This is the diachronic way of looking at it and the synchronic way of looking at it. So if we look now at the diachronic way, we see that there is a leap in quality from the left to the right side, which means that from the actual possible we have a leap to the future that is realized, to a realized a possibility of the actual. Yeah? And the whole thing means it is emergence of the realized from the possible. And the second thing is, as to the synchronic dimension, so we have also here a leaping quality, and that leaping quality means that we would go from the less good to the better. And that would be called the dominance of the better over the good. Okay? This is Ernst Bloch's concrete utopia. What does he mean by that? He said that utopianism is more or less impractical or inconsequential if it is just a construction of the head and not rooted in reality. What we need is we need to find roots in reality, that is, possibilities, which he called kind of real possibilities. Yeah, possibilities which are given with the actual state of affairs. And here it is up to us to decide, to choose between these different possibilities and to say, okay, we would like to have that possibility realized and then to do it. And we do it because we think it is it is something that is which by human criteria is better than what we have now. Yeah, and these are the concrete utopias, and his term was Vorschein, which is, I forgot the English, it's shining through in a way. This means Vorschein, or it is a kind of anticipation. That is, for instance, in WikiLeaks or in Wikipedia or in the all these movements, these commons movements, we see certain islands of things which could be a model for what the future could consist of. And therefore, it is what shines. It's a kind of anticipation of the future. So this is what he says.
Foresight?
It's also, you know, Ernst Bloch belongs to these philosophers like Heidegger who have a certain terminology which is also in German difficult to understand. And they create new words, Vorschein, which is...
It's a beacon.
Sorry?
It's not the beacon, it's not the word.
Beacon? I don't know beacon. I'm sorry.
Beacons of light.
But there's a good...
It shows the way.
Yeah, it's a little light, and it is as if the future would shine into the here and now.
Beacon.
You see a little beacon?
Beacon?
Okay, a beacon, okay. With a P or with a B?
B.
Isn't that a bacon? Bacon is the other thing. Okay.
Not bacon. No.
Not bacon.
Not bacon.
For me, it's bacon. Okay. Okay. Yes. Now I come to fulfill this with the... Did you see what I did? You saw this already. So this... It's just now I do this step model of this evolutionary systems thinking. So it is now, well... Okay, so, okay, now you see, from the left, there is a here and now, yeah, and it goes its way, and what is then to say is there is the so-called not yet. This is what Ernst Bloch said, the not yet is that which is the beacon, so to say, which is then realized in the future, yeah, so that's it. And this can be now transformed into systems thinking. It's the same picture, but it's now in different terminology. So you have space of possibilities at the phase N, and you have this kind of leaping quality, which is then called complexification or simplification, because I think I have no time to talk about this, because every complexification is also a simplification. So, and you have then a space of new possibilities, but the important thing is that a meta-system or a supra-system is emerging, and that means that there are new organizational relations, that is now the structure of the social system, and the systems before are, so to speak, elements of the new suprasystem, and these are the actors, and actors are not only individuals but also combined or collective social actors and so on. Yeah, in the phase n plus one, and yeah, that's it. And what is it? Suprasystem hierarchy, humanism inspired. Reads here, yeah. So, and metasystem transition is open-ended, and open-ended, by that I refer to Popper and his open society. It is open to the future, we say. And yeah, okay. So, summing up, what do we understand by mechanism from the point of a critical social systems theory? I have only 3 points. This is not enough, but this I will I think make it more clear after what I have heard from you. So the first thing is that I would say we have generic self-organization. There is no mechanism that has nothing to do with self-organization. So it's the most general thing, which is the basic of every mechanism, so to say. And that means you have either morphostasis or you have transitional emergence, which is from one social formation to another, or you have self-organization through bottom-up and top-down emergence. So you have also emergence top-down, because at the individual level or at the level of actors there is something new emerging here, which is between agents and structure. And this is on any scale. That is, I can refine it as far as I like. Second thing is, Doug was always talking about tendencies. He always pointed out that the last meeting and the meeting before, and this is the same as we say open causality. You said it, open causality, Phil, and I would like to introduce the term propense by Popper, the old Popper. I like the old Popper because he's talked of propensities and not of laws. Well, he said laws are kind of propensities which give a certain amount of a scope of a bandwidth of possibilities that are realized, but not strict deterministic what is going on. But anyway, it is causal. Everything is caused. So, and now comes the critical drop here.
But it is probabilistic.
If I read his ontology, it's maybe more than probabilistic also. Yeah. So we can interpret it. Yeah. Well, he says probabilistic. Yeah. If we look at the universe, how it did it so far, we can say, okay, in 56% of all cases, we have found the universe did this, and in the other cases, it did not. So, but we don't know what it will do in the future. So it's, I'm not sure if this is probabilistic. Yeah. Okay, there are 3 ways of these kind of mechanisms or dynamisms, yeah, how they are. Because I talked of the sublation of antagonisms, so I have to introduce that term, antagonisms. And this means there's a conflict of contradictory positions. I'm not sure, I did not think about roles. Maybe it's the same. Also in your terminology, it might be role. But maybe position is here better, because a contradiction, you know, a contradiction in propositions, for instance, is like that only one can be true and the other is false. So according to Aristotle and according to formal logic. This year I learned to know Chantal Mouffe, and she is talking about agonisms. So it was the first time I heard the term and looked about what she's talking, what she means by that. And so I take her idea, but I know that she doesn't like how I take it. Anyway, I take it, and so I say there's a second thing which has to do with the contrary positions. A contrary means, for instance, black and white. Both can be there, and there's a mixture of both. So they are not contradictory, they are just contrary, and this is a kind of agonism, I would say. Yeah, this is what I would like to understand by this. And synergism is clear. Synergism is what comes out by self-organization. That is convergence of complementary positions. So the complementarity is the term I take from Maggie. Yeah? So, and I will come back to this in the third chapter. Okay. Now I come to the ITs and information society. How do they work together? So I try to make a categorization of social approaches, of social theory approaches to the relation of technology and society. So I would say the reductionist one. So I have four ways of thinking, and I don't explain this now. So the reductive way of thinking is then mostly called the positivistic way of thinking. And if you go to the issue of how they relate technology and society, so they relate it like that. The technology is the independent variable and society is the dependent variable, and that is called techno-deterministic. It's also called push approach. So there's the opposite, the pull approach, which is a social constructivism, and I would relate it to interpretivism. And the way of thinking is projecting, so it is projected. So from society, you project the properties onto the technology. And it is either explanandum and explanans, or the understanding and the narrative, which are related here, but in that way that society is always the explanans or the narrative. Then we would have the disjunctive way of thinking, that is a kind of saying that technology and society are dual, that they don't have to do anything with each other, or maybe later then they can interact in a certain way, but originally they are independent from each other. So this is a postmodern way of thinking, postmodern as instigated by the French philosophers. And that is, they say there are incommensurable fields. Okay. And the critical thinking now, the last way, this is the integrative way of thinking, and I called it during my time in Salzburg the mutual shaping approach, and mutual means for technology and society shape each other. So it's a kind of circular influence, but clearly it is not, they are not on the same level, as you will see. And it is integrated technology assessment and the design. So this is also a stream which is really there. It's not my invention, but there are people who endorse this kind of thinking. Okay, so this is according to the determinants. Yeah. So you have four ways of looking at the determinants if you just focus on technology and society. Second, if you now include also the values, that is, how are these determinations evaluated, then you have you can cross-table this, and then you have these four ways, techno-determinism, social constructivism, or the dualism, or the mutual shaping approach, and they can approach these values in three different ways. The first way is called utopian, U with an E, which is to say everything is good. Yeah, it's everything is in the right place and it works okay. That is, if you go to the first box, that it says, okay, there's a technological progress, it's a progress, hurrah, and this immediately translates into social progress, no problem. The social constructivism says the opposite, and the dualism says they are not linked with each other, have nothing to do with each other. Because we have so many technology and we are all not happy, for instance. Yeah, so you see this has nothing to do with each other. The dystopian way of seeing this is to talk of regress and not of progress. And to say, okay, the technological regress, what we see in all these technological developments, causes the social regress, or the other way around, in the social constructivism, which says, okay, we have this bad society with these capitalists and so on, and therefore we also have this bad technology for making war and for surveillance and so on and so on. Well, both of them are not practicable, are not consequential, because they don't have an impact on society, except that it is morphostasis. It is morphostatic, because things are as they are, and we cannot change them, or we need not to change them. But we need to change them. Therefore, there is the proactivist approach, which says, okay, we have an obligation, we need to do something, and this is, we want to design. And design means, what are the criteria? What do we want to do? And is it possible to do? Yes, it is possible. There is no determinism from the one side or from the other side. So we can do it. And then, if we go to the information society approaches, we will see that we can order them, all of these approaches, into this table. That is the utopian techno-deterministic variant. They are all about informatization. That is, most of them, it was, I think, also the first, because it was said information society. And by information society, it was said, okay, this is society with computers. Another approach, also a very early approach, was community building approach. That is, we, the consumers, the society, we want to have more communication and so on, and therefore we invented the web, and therefore we use it now. The dystopians, they say, the technological realm is really bad if it is exaggerated in that way it is. That is, the whole reality is virtualized, and this is a bad thing because we have all this stuff of alienation from reality and so on. Or the social constructivist dystopianism is then, okay, it's like Orwell. Yeah, everything is as Orwell foresight, made the foresight. And the dualism decouples it, and the way I would like to think is to design a global sustainable information society, as I have already written in the last paper. So, and we can even now split up the social factors into ecology, economy, policy, and politics and culture. So the interesting thing is maybe that ecology is here, but it is here because it is not technology, because this is the main difference between technology and all the other factors. Yeah? So, and the ecological, for instance, would say, okay, the utopian thing is, oh, we live on the spaceship Earth and we try to manage it, and we can manage it, maybe, yeah. So, and we do it. 10 minutes, oh my dear. Okay, so I just would like to draw your attention that you see that on the left side and on the right side, this is opposites. These are contradictions. Yeah? For instance, in the economic sphere, this is what you were talking about, not from the economic side, but here I put it into the economic level. That is, we have cosmopedia. This is the idea of Pierre Lévy. He said, okay, all the knowledge of the world can be free for everybody. And the other thing is that there is commercialization and commodification of knowledge, and monopolies will arrive. And this is the economic seizure, the economic take of the production of scarcity in that field in order to be able to follow these capitalist rules again. Then we have the panstructum and the infowars and so on. And in the culture sphere, I would like to have this thing on the one hand, leisure and fun, and disinfotainment on the other hand. Yeah. So, and what we need is informed world citizenship. So, and why is this so? How can we think about this? That is all in the middle. This is these theories are contradicting because they describe only one side of the antagonisms. And what we would need is, in the right box, on the bottom, unifying theory for synergism. Okay, so here comes the picture of how I look at this mutual shaping approach to information society, and maybe this is now the mechanism I want to talk of. So the social system, and we have a subsystem, which is the technological one. Therefore, I call it techno-social systems. So, and these are the ICTs, three three functions of ICTs: thinking, communicating, and cooperating. And here we have now the first thing, that is a kind of bottom-up arrow. That's the impact. The impact from technology on the social system, on society, in support of social interests, but not only, because we also have to face unintended consequences, which might be positive or negative, or might also be neutral. And this impact, this is the causal. If you talk about causality, then you see that this is, on the one hand, it is material, because technology is matter here, but it is also effective in a way, yeah, because it affects, it has effects in society, and also the system itself is not only matter, it is also it includes also the actors that use technology. So, and on the other side, you have this top-down arrow. That is, you design technology. You have here the formal cause and the final cause. And you shape it according to social interests. But also here, you have supervenient features, plus or minus. I use the term without resort to the supervenience theory of Kim. Yeah? So I like the term because supervenience for me is so easy to understand. It's like emergence. Yeah? It means emergence. Unintended consequences are emergent and supervenient features are emergent. So this is how it works. So this is now the end of that. I want to differentiate between two processes here. Informationalization is the one I termed. And the second is already termed, not by me, informatization. So what's the difference? Informationalization is the process of raising the problem-solving capacity of the nascent world society to a level that allows for successfully tackling the problems that arise from society's own development. Yeah? That is, we are able to produce that knowledge that we need to set our society on a sustainable path. Yeah? This informationalization can and needs to be based upon informatization, that is, the spread of information and communication technologies. And this makes society more and more responsive to information, but informationalization is not entailed by informatization per se. Because under the premise of antagonisms, which is due to societies of domination, informatization is ambivalent. We talked about ambivalence of technology. And this is due to these antagonisms we have. And this means, on the one hand, informatization reinforces existing social frictions. Yeah, that is, it's like a catalyst. Secondly, it can also spawn new social frictions, that is, new distortures of society, can have new bad effects which would not have been there if this technology would not have been used in that way. And thirdly, it also provides new means for lowering social frictions. This is also the way, and this is also the way as utopianists look at the internet and social web and so on. Yeah? But this is, everything is true. So all of that is true, and we find empirical evidence for every of this kind of way in our capitalist society. Thus, that's a consequence. Informatization has to be tamed so as to be harnessed for informationalization, and informatization and informationalization is the generic dynamism in information society. So all what we speak about, so maybe what you talked about, what Colin was talking about, and what we have with we can have different spheres in which we will find different mechanisms which are working in this information society, in this capitalist information society. They are all manifestations of a dynamism of a higher order, which is, I introduced it in 2013, socialization and individualization, yeah? Which is also a concretization of integration and differentiation, yeah? Which is also true for non-social systems. And the problem is that there are antagonisms that turn this informatization into a perverted socialization, individualization mechanism, and hinders proper informationalization. So this is what I want to point out here. 40 minutes I have now. So this is, these are three examples. We already talked about this. Okay. Now I would have the third chapter, but I don't find time, I guess. Or do you give me
3 minutes?
3 minutes. Okay. I'm hurry. So that is, you see, antagonisms are very important. Antagonisms should be overcome in order to be able to come to a good society, to a global sustainable information society, and therefore we need a design structure. So, this is very quick. This is also in the last book, in the 2013 book, with the exception that the middle part is now called idiotism. Yeah, because in the meanwhile, I read a literature by Neil Curtis. I think he is an Australian. The book is called Idiotism. And he says the idiotes are those persons in Greek democracy who just cared of their private dream, on their own, yeah, and not on the political. Yeah?
The
oikos, okay, but on their own oikos, yeah, and not the oikos of the whole. Yeah. So, and this is, he says that neoliberalism is just the last point of exaggeration of this idiotism. And I say this is, it begins with the eyes, and you can read it in the old paper. So, and here I develop a kind of also kind of mechanism of how to transform an antagonism into a synergism. And this goes over agonism, that is, over transforming the antagonism into agonism. So in order to understand, this is now the background slide, which means you have two levels in the social system, the macro level, the micro level. On the micro level, you have the actors, one and two. They are active, they are self-organizing themselves, they interact with each other, and out of the interaction, there is the bottom-up arrow, which is the reproduction or transformation of the social relations that emerge here, and the social relations work as constraints and enablers top down to them. Okay? So, and on the background of this slide, we can now define what is antagonism. So, antagonistic social relations exist as long as reflection is restricted. So, I take in what I have learned by Maggie Archer about reflexivity. So that is the opponents. They are opponents. They organize themselves in an idiotistic way, which means they don't think of the third, number three. These are the social relations. They take it for a given and don't reflect it, and so they are closed. They have a restricted reflection. And the arrows are sharp, which means it is an antagonism. And also the structure is, you see, there are sharp arrows, which means the structure is, there are antagonistic relations existing objectively outside of the two opponents. Now, we can transform this antagonism into an agonism if we extend reflection in three dimensions. So first we can extend cognition. And that means, okay, one of these two opponents can say, okay, I try now to reflect on the relations. And if I reflect the relations and see they are antagonistic and I don't want to be an antagonist anymore, So I'm not an opponent of the other, I'm a kind of proponent, because I think what I could fancy of how the third could look like, of how the new relations could be, I need not to be an opponent of the other, and we could have a win-win situation. And so it is necessary to make a step out of this, and therefore I took the term unilateral actions in advance. This is like in the arms race we had, and also still we have today. So it is very important to set the first step, to make the first step, and to say no, okay. And by the way, this was the new way of thinking of Gorbachev and his clique around him. So in the cognition, you have also to extend your communication. That is, you talk with the other about this, yeah, and you deliberate with him about this third. And then comes also this kind of cooperation on the cooperative level, which is the third level, which explicitly says, okay, sorry, here's still opponent. I wanted to have proponent here, I forgot. Okay, it should be also proponents. And you see that now what the proponent one does is he relates to the third, and then the third relates back to him. And that's how he works and how he reacts. But this is not everything he should do, because this is not yet the click, this is not yet the switch over to the new relations. This comes only now. That is, if then they interrelate their relation to the third in a certain way, that is, if I relate my position to the relations, and then look from this relations to the other, to the ego, to the altar, and he does the other thing. So we have a kind of agreement of like a organistic, they say, division of labor, for instance, or whatever. Yeah. So that's it. And then we have a synergistic way of the whole thing, which means that there's no antagonism, but everything is synergetic. Right. So, okay, that's the heaven on earth.
Thank you.
Very nice paper, very conceptual.